Okay, the last thing that I have to do, just about time, I think, is what to do if you're faced with a fairly horrendous looking equation that involves several square roots. This square root of 1 plus x minus square root of 2x plus 1 is 0. What do you do with this? Well, with these things, you always take the square root over the other side and then square it.
Because we got extra time.
Sorry?
We got extra time. It's from 10 past 1 till 10 to 2.
10 to 2, is it?
Yeah.
Is that right?
So we were a bit confused.
Okay.
No, I mean, that's what we had on our
that
schedule.
That makes more sense.
So.
Otherwise, this time, right? I've been trying.
Yeah.
Thank you. I Okay, so welcome to the Computation and Logic lecture course. Looks like a full lecture theatre, so thanks for all turning up. I hope we don't have more than the lecture theatre can hold. You have read this while you were waiting for me to set up. And this is just what I said, actually, when I did my little 15-minute segment in the introductory lecture for the entire Informatics 1 course. So kind of you already know it. So it should be reasonably well organized. You get lecture notes, tutorial exercises are all on the web just now, the website. I was just checking, that's why I was rushed up to the back. There are boxes full of paper copies of the lecture notes and the tutorial exercises. For some reason, I don't think we've got the paper copies of the slides yet, although I did ask for them. They're not there as far as I can tell. So do collect, you don't need to rush out and collect them now, because you don't need the lecture notes in this lecture particularly, nor do you need the tutorial exercises. But do take them on the way out. If for some reason you forget to take one, or you're rushing out or something, or if there are not enough left, because the informatics teaching organization didn't make enough copies, I don't know, I guess they have, then you can always get copies from the informatics teaching office on level 4. So I guess you've already been told about that, right? Do you know about the informatics teaching office? It's where you go for anything that's to do with the administration of the course, and it's on level 4 of this building. Just go up the stairs at that end, and the door's there. They have normal working hours. They'll be there to help. So you can always get stuff from there, or you can download it from the web if you just want an electronic copy. So you should have plenty of everything from there. The teaching assistant for the course is Sherry Arbijani. So if there's anything about the course, you have some question or something that you want to ask, something you think you need a little bit of help with, you can mail him and he'll try and help. Your tutor should be the first point of contact, though. You get a tutorial every week. You'll be given a schedule. You'll be told which tutorial group you're in by the informatics teaching organization. They won't have done that yet. And I'm told that the tutorial exercises were actually starting next week, but I think it'll actually be the week after. In other words, a week later than I had thought. So actually a side effect of that is that the dates you see on those tutorial exercises are probably 1 week in advance of the actual dates they'll be. The dates shifted between when I wrote the exercises and when the arrangements were made. But you'll be contacted when those start. And after you've done the first one, you'll just get in the habit of doing the tutorials after every week, I hope. Do go to the tutorials, because they're teaching you stuff as well as the lectures here. You'll get a lot of feedback from the tutors, so they should be able to help you an awful lot with what you do. If that relationship works, then everything kind of churns along. The other thing that you get is WebCT, which is an electronic system that we use for organizing other supplementary material. I won't talk to you about that just yet, but in another lecture or two, I'll say a little bit about that. So that's that for the background. Everybody happy about that? Kind of know how to get started, I hope. No questions? Okay. Right, so what I want to do in this lecture is talk to you a little bit about logic and why you should be interested in logic. And the other thing I want you to do is to get a little bit of practice just in describing things in logic. How many of you have used, say, something like propositional logic or logic before, in a previous life? Not that many. So we're really starting from the basics here. That's good, because that's what I expect. If everybody put their hand up and said, "Oh yeah, I'm fully familiar with first order predicate logic," then I would have been a little bit worried that you'd be bored. So this will be pretty new to most of you. I'll take it easy, but it does ramp up fairly quickly. So the first lecture might actually even the first lecture it's going to challenge you a little bit. And the way I run these lectures normally is talk a little bit around the subject. Then I give you a little problem to think about at the beginning of the lecture, and then at the end of the lecture we come back and we solve that little problem. So it gives you something to kind of chew over at the back of your mind while I'm talking about all the stuff you need. So you get the problem, the bit you need to solve it, and then we solve it at the end. It's normally the way I do it. Okay. And the other thing you should know is that the lecture course is really, we go for the whole semester, but sort of it's a game of two halves, sort of, they interrelate. So the first half that we're getting now, the first six lectures or so after this one, is the logic bit. And logic is really to do with describing things that are true. What is true about the world? And as you'll see, it's very, very versatile. You know, many things are true about the world that you might want to describe, and some you can't, and some you can, and some you can't. And the second part of it is really to do with describing state. And I talk about finite state machines and those sorts of things. So this first bit, I'll be talking about logic, the beautiful clarity of things that are true about the world. And I shouldn't forget this quote. So one good reason for talking about logic at the very beginning is, as Manon Waldinger said, it's the calculus of computer science. Pretty much, once you scrape away all the varnish, if you eventually need to be able to talk precisely in an abstract sense about some computer system, you end up coming down to something to do with logic or something to do with finite state machines. In the end, that's where you end up. Of course, many people use many other different ways of describing things in practice for particular ends, but this is the kind of elementary stuff that you need. And a little bit about the history of it, I won't dwell on this. If I have time later on in the lectures, I'll talk a little bit more historically about this, but I don't need to talk about history here. And here's why. Logic is very old, about as old as you can get. But when it started, it was really talking about human things, human systems of argument. And this lasts for a huge long time. You know, it's not much use. Well, other than from a philosophical sense, where it's of course of great use, but from a technical sense, it's not much use for a very long period of time. About the mid to late 19th century, we were starting to think of it as a mathematical language. Mathematicians get interested in it, but still, there is no computer science or anything like that, of course, at that time. So it's just of mathematical interest. Then, so predating computer science, it starts to be thought about as something that's kind of mechanical. It's kind of a mechanical thing. And then once you get back to the middle 20th century, then you start to get this very, very powerful pairing of the mathematics and the actual computation. And that's why you get the kinds of logical structures that we'll be starting to deal with in these courses. So I'm not a philosophical logician. And the way I will teach you, if some of you, for those of you who have maybe experienced logic before, usually in these classes I get a few people who have done logic and philosophy, and the treatment will be very different. Think of me as being a bit like a plumber. Right, so I plumb things together. I use my logic to connect different things and to get different effects and to under-specify things in different ways. So I'm just an engineer. Right? There's much more you can do in logic that is broader than that. But here we focus on its engineering use. Although the tools we're using aren't so different. So why is it good? Because nearly everything you'll do is somehow built on it. So gates in computer circuits implement a Boolean logic. That's kind of no surprise, I guess, to a lot of people. Something that might be more of a surprise is looking at the boundaries. So when people, one thing is to build systems, and we enjoy doing that, and that's great, and you can build things that surprise you. But also people wonder about the systems that you can't build. You know, if we have machines built on particular principles, which are the ones that we could never build? And then you need an abstract language to talk about those sorts of things, because you can't demonstrate the machine, evidently, because it can't be built. You want to be able to say what that is. You need abstract languages to do that. Some programming languages, like database query languages, actually like the functional logic that Phil Ward will be talking to you about, actually have their roots in logic. You can't really understand them deeply unless you understand some aspects of logic. Semantics of languages. So if you want to compare two languages, is this language more powerful than this other language? You need some lingua franca that's not the languages themselves. Verifying systems. If you want to build a secure system, or if you want to build a system to a high degree of integrity, how are you going to reason about the integrity of that system? You need to have some language in which you can abstractly reason. Those are typically either logics directly or have their grounding somehow in logic. Things like the semantic web, the kind of wackier, well, not wacky actually, because it actually works quite well for particular systems, the kind of outer edge of things that are being done in web environments depend for their structure on logic. If you look at RDF or something like that that's helping to build the semantic web, then the only real way to understand that is by appeal to abstract logic. And that's why, since it's applicable so widely across the piece, that's why it's a lingua franca for a lot of informatics research. That's why you need to know it. Okay. So that's enough of the religious material. That's just telling you why it is that you should be interested. And I want to give you the motivating problem. So to do that, you sort of you should hate me for this, but you shouldn't really. I'm going to actually give you a more complicated logic than the one that I'll mostly use in the course. So I'm giving it at the very beginning, I'm giving you something that's more complicated than you're actually going to need for most of the course. And the reason why I'm doing that is just to give you a view of what it is that we're heading towards. Because remember, this is just the first year course that you're doing. We're never going to get into really complicated aspects of logic. We're going to stick to propositional logic, which I'll explain to you in a moment. But I just want to give you an idea of what it feels like to represent things in logic first. Very first step, if you're doing anything in logic, is you have to write it down. You have to say it. Because if you can't say it, you can't reason about it. So predicate logic kind of works like this. Or let's start. What makes it a predicate logic is you've got variables, and that you've got predicates that apply to variables. So every structure that I write here, so everything is, we're in the clunky mathematical world, so everything is a structure. And we'll have structures, and we'll infer things about other structures from the structures that we've got. So the only way I can write down a structure in predicate logic is I have a predicate, and it applies to a variable. So let's take this one. So if I say film to whatever it is, that means that whatever it is a film, right? It's like Mars Attacks is a film. So when I write down film, brackets, Mars Attacks, bracket, I'm saying Mars Attacks is a film. And you kind of understand intuitively what I meant when I said that. So now you can relate your notion of Mars Attacks, very nice film, to the thing that I've just written down with the brackets. That step is the intuitive step. That's the bit where you say, here's the world in all its complexity, and I'm going to write it down just that way. And you needn't, predicates can apply to more than one argument. So I could say, if I need to talk about actors, then if I say actor, some film, some person, it means that that person, P, acted in that film, F. So I can say, Jack Nicholson was an actor in Mars Attacks. Yeah, simple, right? Just relations. So these predicates, when you have more than one argument, so predicates, arguments. More than one argument, you're relating the different things that you're talking about. So director is a relation between Tim Burton and Mars Attacks. Right? Happy about all that. That's the kind of basic bit. So here's the vocabulary that I'm going to use. Really what I'm doing is I'm defining a vocabulary for talking about a problem. And I make those decisions. That's the intuitive step. That's the bit where I go from the horribly complicated world into the nice crystalline world of mathematics. So I'm going to also use director. FP means that person P directed film F. And Oscar X means that X got an Oscar. So when I'm doing this, I'm going to obey the following convention, that words that start with a lowercase letter, like Oscar, director, actor, film, are constants. Words that begin with an uppercase letter, like X or F or P, are variables. So variables can map it. Variables can represent anything. So I could have a particular constant for the X here, which is Glenn Close, or I could have another binding for it. Okay, I bind variables to constants. Actually, I can bind variables to structures, but let's not go there for the moment. Okay, happy about it. Variables, constants. Now's the bit where I explain to you why this is more than I'll typically deal with in this course, because typically I won't be dealing with variables, actually. And so I'll be using a propositional logic. And in a propositional logic, all I ever have is constants. So I'll never have arguments to these predicates. We probably wouldn't have film, because it means it's a film. I mean, that kind of doesn't mean much, but you could say it's, you know, or maybe in a limited context, I could say such and such, I have a film or something like that. Okay, so it's a more limited way of talking about things. You can only say things that are constants, right? So it has some limited variability, but that's the one we'll typically stick with, because I want to spend most of my time talking about how you manipulate these expressions, not about all the complexities of dealing with variables. Okay, so the reason I mention that now is because I don't want to scare you when I start talking about the variables and we get kind of halfway through and you go, oh, gee, I mean, this is, you know, it's all this stuff with variables I don't really understand. I'm dead in this course. You won't be, because we won't be requiring you to understand a lot of that subtlety. Okay, so happy with this so far? Good? Okay, you understand what I mean when I'm writing those things. Yeah? Good. Okay. So here's the problem that I'd like you to be able to solve, which we will solve at the end. You don't have to solve, we'll solve it together at the end. Don't worry, I'm not going to leave you on your own. How can you actually describe these questions? Imagine this thing is actually a database. It's not a bad way of representing a database, actually. There you go. So that's all this information about films. It's an IMDb. If IMDb could maybe have used this kind of representation. It doesn't, but it could have. Then how could you actually ask these questions of the database? I want to know which Oscar-winning films are directed by an actor. Blah, blah, blah. All of these different types of questions. Okay. If you want to be able to access your big fancy database, then you better be able to ask the question. Right? Otherwise, your big fancy database isn't going to tell you anything. So how would you do that? You're going to need to formalize these questions in some way. And by the end, we'll come back and be able to do that. Right, okay. To do that, we're going to need some notation. So, this is going pretty fast through notation. All you need for now, because you get plenty of practice doing this on the way through the course, so for the next 4 weeks, you'll get plenty of practice at fiddling around with this. So I'm just going to give you the intuitions now. All this lecture is intuitions about how to understand these connectors. In the next few lectures, we go through a lot of detail about how to understand what they really mean. So the intuitions is the following. Let me read you this expression just as a piece of English. This says, funny upside down A means for all x, P of some constant A of x and Q of x implies for some y, R x, y holds. Okay. So let me go through this expression. The P A of x, P is a predicate name, just like we saw before, just like film or director or whatever. A is a constant, x is a variable. Right, so you should have been able to figure that out right away because I told you a moment ago. These guys are the logical connectives. So not P is the negation of P. It's saying intuitively that P is not true. We go through in detail with the semantics of these in later lectures. P and Q means that P and Q are both true. Sometimes, just so you know, you'll come across notational variants of these. So sometimes not gets written as a thing that looks a bit like a broken stick. You sometimes see it like that. Sometimes and gets written as an upside down V. This is kind of historical throwback. P or Q means that P or Q is true. And in the jargon, P or Q is often called a disjunction. Quite often I'll call these things disjunctions. Quite often I'll call P and Q conjunctions. So conjunctions, two things have to be true together. Disjunctions, either one could be true, or both could be true, actually. But as long as one of them is true, that's fine. P implies Q means that if P is Q is true, then Q must be true. That's often said informally as P implies Q. This is the operator, we'll come to it later, this is the operator that caused people most intellectual difficulty, actually, with formal logics. But we'll come on to it later. But for now, just intuitively understand it is if P is true, then Q must be true. Sometimes you get a double implication, which is basically P implies Q and Q implies P. Right? So these are the logical connectives, and then you can quantify the variables. So the quantification, in a moment I'll say a little bit more about that, but the quantification intuitively, you got a variable, and you're defining some relations involving that variable. Does that relation apply to every instance of that variable, or does it just apply to not necessarily more than one? Could be more than one, but at least one. And so that's the distinction we're making. So for all xp means that for every x, p is true. For all the x's, p is true. If you choose any value for x, it's true. For some xp is true. I just need one, and then the expression is true. Okay, so all you need to be is intuitively happy with these operators for now. Happy? Right. By the way, all these slides are on the web, so you just you can pick them up if you want. And somebody was asking, unless the technology is failing me, all the lectures are videoed as well. So if for some reason you can't remember what I said, give us a little while just to actually collect the lecture and the video and massage it for the web. But in a reasonable period of time, they should start to appear. I can't remember exactly where on the web, but we'll tell you at some point. Okay. The other thing that you need to know that is boringly technical that you need to know is about precedence of operators. you want to be able to know, if you write something like A and B or C implies D, you want to know, when you read it unambiguously, whether that means A and B or C implies D, or whether it means A and B or C implies D, or whether it means, what else could it mean? A and B or C implies D, right? It depends on how you read it. Which, you know, which reading do you have of that? Because those things mean very different things. So I say A is true and B or C implies D, that means something very different from if I say if A and B or C is true, that implies D. So I have to be able to read that expression unambiguously. And so I want to be able to take an expression that's written that way. It's very convenient to write it without having to say anything more. I want to be able to I want to read that unambiguously. One way to be able to read it unambiguously is to start bracketing things. So I could say, okay, the reading is A and B or C implies D. And then I could put brackets around it. So this, this then is very easy to see. So I can say A and B or C implies D, right? That's completely unambiguous. You can't, knowing what, if you know what a bracket, what the brackets are doing, they're putting together bits of expression, then there is no ambiguity in reading that that expression, right? So then what I want is some way of being able to write this and know that it means this. And the way that that's usually done is by talking about the president's ordering. And there's different ways of thinking about that, but the simplest way is to think about what expression is going to dominate. So here are the rules. If you've got one of these guys, then that dominates most. So if you read something like this, there's the arrow, it dominates. It's going to be the highest thing up in the expression. If you imagine building the expression like a tree, right? So here's the tree, this is the top level one in the tree, and then this is a branch, and this is a branch. And then inside here, there's another branch, which goes down here and down here. Then inside here, there's another branch between the A and the B. Can you see that? I can draw it on the board, but I think you can probably see it, right? Right? So I want to be able to describe the tree-like structure of that term. So if you've got one of these guys, it dominates. These guys, the ands and the ors, they're the next most dominant, right? So then if you've got one of those that, so this guy beats one of these. These guys are the same and not is the least dominant. I haven't got one in there. If I had not in here, it would be lower down in the tree. Then the question is, if you've got two of equal dominance, what happens? And the answer is, the one on the right dominates. So I've got A and B or C. The one on the right dominates, which is the or. So that's A and B or C. That's how it works. You have different systems of precedence and different ways of talking about precedence, and it's not actually a big deal at the moment. If you're ever in doubt, you just write the bracketed thing, and you never need to worry about precedence in your whole life. So this is just something that you need to know about. Don't worry about it too much in this lecture, but it's an issue. Okay. This bit here, I just want to skate through reasonably quickly, but just to give you an idea for this, because it's something that when people are talking technically about most of the lectures that I'll give to you, will be technical lectures where we're talking about, you know, particular bits of mechanics. Remember, I'm a kind of engineering type of logician. I just do the stuff where the brackets move around. But there's an intuitive step. There's the bit where I said in the example, when I write film brackets Mars attacks, it means Mars attacks is a film. And I appeal to your intuitions to what that means. You know what a film is sort of as much as I do. But in subtly different ways, of course. So there's this intuitive step. Every time that for people who spend a lot of time writing stuff in logic, and actually, even though I'm an engineer, I spent a lot of time representing things in logic. You know, probably most of my actual active professional working life is doing stuff like that, then you spend a lot of time wrestling with things that are actually intuitive things. And there's all sorts of things which make it ambiguous how you would describe things in logic. Inside a logic, there's no ambiguity. Once you've fixed your logical system, once you know how it is that you're going to infer things, if your logical system is well engineered, there actually is no ambiguity. Outside there, it's the world, which is full of ambiguity. And when you do an engineering job, you bridge between the horribly ambiguous natural world and the crystalline mathematical world of logic. There is this step. Here are four of the things that cause things to be a bit
bit iffy in taking that step. One is ambiguity in the world, one is binary choices, another one is equivalence between expressions, and the fourth one is differences in logical systems. I'll talk a little bit about each one of these. So ambiguity, here's a good example of ambiguity. So you spot, here's another, you spot that Dave's hair is thinning, which it is. Question is, how do you write that down? You're going to have to write that down in something that you're going to represent in, let's say, predicate logic, like the predicate logic I gave at the beginning. Are you going to say, without going into the details of how you'd actually formally represent it, but what are you going to say? Are you going to say he's bold? I think not. Is he going bold? Maybe. Is he partially bold? Which is different from going bold. It means you've partially gone bold, right? Possibly. Or is it something much more precise? Is he 20% below the mean follicle density for Caucasian males aged 44? Actually, a little bit older than that. Maybe if you do it this way, then what you're actually, this is an interesting one, because these ones are kind of appeals directly to your intuition. What does it mean when I write down, if I write down bold brackets Dave? So Dave is the constant, bold means it's bold, right? And then I can appeal to your intuition to say, oh, well, it means that or that or that, maybe. This guy's a bit different, because what I'm doing is I'm saying, okay, I'll tell you what boldness means in terms of some other concepts. Okay, bold if such and such. Okay, and that takes me on to the boundary choices bit. So if you get involved in this line of work, which I hope you will, because it's the nicest job in the world, in my particular, my opinion, then you get involved in describing where it is that you're, in defining where it is that you're going to stop describing the world. You're going to describe the world somehow, and then you have to, somewhere you have to stop, because you're never going to keep defining the whole world. So here we go. Here's the film example. Oscar P means that some person got an Oscar, right? And that's what I said. That was the appeal to your intuition. But, oh, yeah, thanks, Dave. I understand what that means. I know what an Oscar is. But that didn't tell us some things. Okay, so it didn't tell us which film the person got an Oscar for. So I could invent some new thing, a new relation called Oscar winner. That's some new concept, that's great. And if somebody's an Oscar winner, that means that they got an Oscar. So I define Oscar P in terms of something that's more complicated, it's got film in it. Right? So I'm starting to, I'm supplying more axioms describing my system. So an axiom is an expression that you use in order to describe a particular system. Or I could talk about time. So I could say, oh, an Oscar winner, that's not quite enough detail. Just talking about the film isn't good enough, because I need to know when the film came out. And so then I introduce another one. So it's Oscar win now, person, film, and a time, T. And if I go an Oscar win, that implies I've got an Oscar winner. So one implies the other. And I just keep defining one thing in terms of the other. I could have made this more complicated. I could have. So here, for example, to make this more complete, actually, you have spotted, where did the F come from? I could have said, okay, film F and person F and Oscar winner PF implies Oscar. There may be even more concepts coming. I can make these things richer and richer and richer. We keep going all day and tonight and so on, and we're still describing. So at some point, you say, I've described it enough for the purposes of what I want to demonstrate. And in the abstract world of reasoning about logics, ironically, that's rather easier to decide, I think, than in the practical world of applying logics, where you're dealing directly with the actual world, and you have to make some sometimes quite arbitrary boundary choices. Another thing that means that when you write down an expression, it doesn't always unambiguously, well, the same concept isn't necessarily unambiguously described by, it could be more than one formal representation of the same concept, is equivalences. So, and this is purely a technical issue. This has nothing to do with intuition. This has to do with the nature of logical languages. So if I write down A implies B, that's exactly the same. I think it's the next lecture. I'll be explaining why it's exactly the same. As right as saying not A is true or B. Okay. I told you this would make you go. Let's leave it for the next lecture about exactly why that's true. That's something just to stack that and we'll come back. You can think it, mull it over in your mind a little bit, but that's logically equivalent to that. And that's a very important thing to know next time, not this time. Right? Stack that one, come back to the next lecture and you'll find out why. So given that's true, which is the better one to say? Should I write it this way? Should I write it this way? They mean the same. It depends on who's going to how you want to solve the problem, what sort of logical system you're going to use to solve it, and it depends on who you want to read this. Because there's always two things when you're using logic in practice. One is the machinery. I'm going to automatically do some proof on the logic that I've got. And then that, then the way you represent the axioms in your in the system that you're describing is going to have to suit the theorem proof that you use. And another one is, who's going to check that it intuitively makes sense? That's when I say A implies B or not A or B. Actually, I am faithfully representing the horribly complicated, ambiguous, real-world thing that I'm trying to describe. Okay, so it depends which choice you make. Okay, a little bit more about similarities. Okay, that one we've seen, and you went, and we'll come back to that one. These ones will be easier. So let's look at conjunction versus disjunction, so ands and ors. So if I say A and B is true, I can turn that into something that's got nots and ors in it and no ands in it, and it means the same thing. So saying A and B must both be true, right? That's the same as saying it can't be true, so it's not true, that A is false and B is false, or B is false. Because if A or B is false, then A and B cannot be true. So, right? Happy with that one? I love logic because you can do this stuff. Right? So I might as well write I could write this, or I could write this. This is more complex to look at, but it doesn't have an and in it, if you are allergic to ands for some reason. I mean, later lectures will come on to good reasons why you might be allergic to some of these expressions. Right? And then A or B is the same as saying it's not true that A and B are both false. Because if A and B were both false, then A or B couldn't be true. And next lecture, I think it's next lecture, I'll be giving you a little system where you can look at expressions like these and absolutely, positively convince yourself that those things make sense, right? So for now, I'm appealing to your intuitions. I just want your intuition. Tomorrow, then, well, not tomorrow, but it'll be next week, Thursday, then I'll be appealing to actually your intellect rather than your intuition. Okay. Next one, universal quantification. So I'm not going to be talking very much at all in the lectures about universal quantification, but I think it's nice for you to know this, because there's this beautiful link between universal quantification and conjunction. So suppose, instead of saying X is unbounded, X can be anything you like, just suppose I say I'll bound it. I can tell you what the instances of X are. At least I can think about what the instances of X are. So suppose I'll write them down. All the instances of X are A1, A2, so on to AN. I don't care what N is. So there's lots and lots of instances of X. And I'll count them all up for you. Then if I write for all X, P of X, that's equivalent to saying P of A1, P of A2, blah, 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 P of AN, conjunctively. Because if P of X is true for every X in that bunch, then it's true for P of A1. And right? So one of these big A's is like a big and. So one way of remembering it's an upside down A, right? It's a big and. That's true for all of the instances. And actually, interestingly enough, if I get back to all the instances, these things, notice what these don't have in them. They don't have any variables. So if I have some nice bounded domain and I want to be not to use variables, what I can do is I can take my quantity, and I know what all the constants are that I can replace in these positions. I can grant them all out. Whoops. I just dropped my... In grounding out my variables, I dropped the microphone. And that's just one big conjunction. So universal quantification is just a big conjunction. Surprise, surprise, because logic's funny that way. You get this beautiful symmetry with an OR. So... same thing, all the instances of X, for some X, P of X is equivalent to P of A1 or P of A2 or however many. Must be one of them. Okay? So you kind of get the idea that we can, this thing that we can do in logics where we can play around with replacing one operator with another determine how we do the replacement. I've been doing it here just to give you an intuition for how these kind of interrelate, but later on we'll talk a bit more about how you do this in a much more methodical way. Okay, so, perfect timing. Right, you are now up for solving these problems. To do this, I need to write down something on the board. I want to remind you what these are. I'm going to give you a tiny little bit of time to think about it. So you've got things, you've got our film. Okay. You've got actor. FP. You've got director. FP. And you've got Oscar. X, where X can be either a film or a person. So F here stands for a film, P is some person, right? So that's where you are. You've got these relations that you can use, and you've got the logics connected and or not implication, and you've got your quantifier for all exists. And then the question is, how would you use those structures to write down that question, which you're going to ask off your database? In your database, you've got all the instances of these things.
Can you use a logic operator within one of those little data structures? Like, could you say Oscar F4P or is FPX?
It's a good question. For our purposes, no.
Okay.
There are some situations where you would want to do that. Actually, I think we do touch on them in later lectures. But for now, the relations are kind of sacrosanct. Imagine you're constructing one of these things as a big tree. And what you're doing is these little things are like little apples on the tree. There are leaves on the tree, right? They're sitting at the bottom. And then you connect them with the logical connectors, and it grows and grows and grows until you've got a big, complicated expression. The wonderful thing about logic is, as you build that expression, the larger connectors preserve the semantics from the smaller ones. You can build and build and build. You'll see that later on in this lecture. Just now, let's try. Spend about 10 seconds thinking about that one. You don't need to write anything, but just think what you would write, because I think it's quite nice in these lectures that you don't just sit and kind of absorb it and then go away thinking, what on earth would it be like to do that?
Does this mean by an actor of any film?
Oh yes, good question. By an actor of any film. That was a very good question, for reasons that we'll see in a moment. Just a moment to think about it. You don't need to write anything, just think about it. Or if you can't think about it, think about P or whatever you want. It's a good idea to think about it. Right, and then I'll show you the answer. Okay. Here's the first step towards getting the answer. So let's try and write it in English in a funny, clunky sort of English that's a bit closer to the logic. So what I want to prove is that there exists an Oscar-winning film and its director, film its director, and there exists a film in which that director was a film actor. Right? Happy that's kind of clunky. I mean, nobody would actually say this because that's a terrible way to say it in English.
Doesn't that change the meaning? Since the first question asks for the number of films, and second is...
Oh, no, doesn't ask
for
any number
for
of films.
The existence of films.
This just says, which Oscar-winning films? Tell me an Oscar-winning film. I don't have to... let me answer that question in a moment. I think I see what you're getting at. Let me just check that it didn't change. No, that's okay. Here's the way I would represent that formally. Actually, because there are different ways of representing things formally, remember what I was saying before, there are actually, even for this one, you could represent it slightly differently. Here's the way I do it. So here's Oscar F. This says this film got an Oscar. There exists some F such that Oscar F, right? And here's its director, the director of F. Notice it's the same F, same film, was P. Person P. So there exists some F and P such that F got an Oscar, the director F is P, and this is why your question is good, and there's some possibly different film, that could be the same film, might be a different film, but it's a different variable, some F1 such that P was an actor in F1. Now, suppose let's get to your question. So you said, but don't we want to actually get all of these films? Right. So what our system then would do would be to say, okay, here's how you generate me one. Solve this. Give me an instance for this. It will be whatever that is. I don't know which film said Oscar-winning director. I'm sorry. We'll give you an instance. But then if you keep asking it for more instances, it'll give you them all. Right. Which would be the normal way. Or you could ask it to generate you the set of all of those instances. Give me the set of FP and F1 such that this expression holds. Would be the way to do it. Okay? That one. We'll whiz through these just to make it better. It doesn't really matter. By the way, don't get... It's not my business to make you feel inadequate. So it should be that these things that you can't really just sit down and think, here's the representation of these after having listened to me for 30 minutes. I'm not expecting you to be able just to go out and do these things. You need to get some practice in tutorials and so on. Don't worry about it. Okay. What is most important is you understand what I'm doing and what I'm about here. Okay. Which Oscar-winning actors have directed themselves? This is a bit similar to the one before, actually. Right, let me get just straight on to that. That's like saying, prove that there exists a film and an Oscar-winning actor in it, and that the same person is the director of that film. Not so different from the one that you saw before. In fact, I think you only need to do one thing, if I remember. I'll give you a moment to think about this. We're kind of a bit pushed for time. I'll give you a moment on this one, and then we'll go quickly through the other three. Okay, I'll brutally cut short. Actually, some of you are having a go. What the hell? I'll give you a little bit. You don't have to have a go, and you don't need to feel inadequate, as I said before, if you can't do this right now. This is the very first lecture I'm giving the predicate calculus, which is kind of an insane thing to do, except I just want you to get the intuition. And then we go to the propositional one for most of the rest. But I think it's the reason why I'm giving you this up front right now is because I just think it's so important to understand that you have a representation that has to do with influence. It's not completely abstract. Okay, let's go to it. I think it looks like that. This says, for some F and P, P got an Oscar and was an actor in film F, and that same P was a director in that same film, so P and F are the same, which is rather like what you saw before, except here we had to invent a new variable, because as you pointed out, it could have been any film, not necessarily the same one. So there, you can make those kinds of distinctions. And once you get into this, you start to spot those kinds of distinctions. And think, oh, do I need to bind that variable? Do I not? If you have some aptitude for this, you quickly build up this kind of facility. Okay, query three. Which directors have directed more than one film? Or to put it another way, prove that there are two films with the same director, and those are not the same film. That would be good enough, wouldn't it? Actually, this actually highlights something else that's quite useful to know. I think a lot of people who are quite good at doing this kind of representational task are quite good at two things, actually. One is understanding what the connectives mean and just the mechanics of everything. And the other one is doing this step, where you take something that's kind of very ill-formed statement in English. It kind of has a lot of... It's brilliant in English. It's exactly the way you should write such a thing in English. But it's not quite the logical expression. And you just kind of take that little step towards thinking about it with the quantifiers in the back of your mind. And the connectors. Okay. So I'm going to whiz through this one. Here we go. So there exists some F1, F2, and P such that P was a director of F1 and P was a director of F2. And it's not true, and I had to introduce a new connective. Damn, sorry, I should have told you about that. This particular one says equal to means they're the same. And so actually, you shouldn't have answered this one without inventing this particular expression. I should have mentioned that one before. Okay. Actually, in most kind of logics that people use in practice, there will be more connectives than the primitive logical connectives I've given. like equal to if you're in predicate cup. Okay? Next one. Query 4. Which films have more than one director? Or to put it another way, prove that there exists a film which there exists two directors and these are not the same person. Actually, it's kind of an analogous problem. Right? It's kind of a similar trick you're trying to pull here. So, if you weren't a little bit pushed for time, I'd like to give you a little bit of time. I'm going to give you time to collect your stuff on the way out, which is why I'm a little bit careful here. Okay, I'll quiz on just one. Here we go. This says, sum F, P1, and P2. There's a director for a film for